From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Have you made room in the compost heap for all that incoming organic material about to be created during your fall cleanup? Compost is today's topic with Associate Director Carrie Oceans of the U.S. Composting Council. And we'll talk about everything from best how-to practices to improve your results to all those claims about compostable plastic bags and devices promising to make instant compost. More in a moment, but first this message.
Underwriting support by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, supplying landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners with new ideas and high-quality flower bulbs for fall planting. Plant tulips, plant daffodils, plant Color Blends this fall. Available at colorblends.com.
Carrie Oceans is a lifelong backyard composter, besides his day job as associate director at the U.S. Composting Council, an industry group founded in 1990 to promote compost utilization and recycling of organic materials to benefit its members, society, and the environment. I'm so glad he's here today to lend some of his insights at this key moment in our composting year. Hi, Carrie, how are you?
Fantastic. Nice to be here.
And how's the compost?
Oh, hey, heating up, as we say in our business.
Cool. No, not cool. So you're composting in your backyard in the Capital Region of New York State. But before we get started with kind of that and some of your insights and tips and advice, sure. I wanted to just know quickly about the U.S. Composting Council. What does it do? It's kind of an industry group, yes?
Yes, just like any industry group needs a professional association to support itself and educate itself and advance the industry, we have one. So the U.S. Composting Council has about 800 members, and those members are mostly companies that are engaged in manufacturing compost. Some mm-hmm. of them are municipal, some of them are private, some of them are nonprofits, and they run the gamut from small community scale compost to mega facilities that bring in, you know, literally thousands of tons a day to make compost out of.
Wow. At home, you're not doing thousands of tons a day. I know that. But you've been doing it as long as you've been gardening, I think, for decades, just like me, yes?
Oh, absolutely. Since back in the college days when I moved into a community household and there was a garden and we learned about, oh, you have to make this compost stuff and started doing it then. And I remember my first year collecting all the leaves and making a pile and then going out in the spring after the thaw and digging into it and nothing had happened. Oh my God, I was so upset. I said, okay, there's more to this than I realized then. And that started me on a lifelong journey, and really when you do it right and we pile up these materials and it gets hot, that's just a miracle to me. And that has kept me interested in it.
Yeah. So do you follow any kind of rules? Because, if you read books or garden books, everybody has their advice on this is right and this is wrong and this what goes in and what doesn't. And
sure.
What about you? What's your set of guidelines?
Yeah, I'm pretty liberal in what goes into my compost pile. I guess I've been doing it long enough that, it's pretty hard to mess up if you follow some basic rules. Things like keeping it moist, not too hot, not too dry. Don't overload the food so you don't get smells and maggots. There's some basic tips I've learned over the years that have helped me keep my composting going, even over the winter. And yeah, as you mentioned, last year I moved up to the Capital District of New York. So after 10 years, 12 years in California, so it's a different environment. And I had to relearn some of the things that I learned growing up here in the Northeast, but it was successful.
So you said, for instance, not putting in too much food. And by that, do you mean kitchen wastes and so forth, which can attract people worry? They write to me a lot. They say, oh, I'm afraid I'm going to get animals, blah, blah, blah. I just kind of dig a hole with it. I keep a fork or a shovel out by my heap, an old shovel. And I just kind of, stick it in and wedge a hole and throw the food stuff underneath a foot or two,
Yeah, absolutely. My favorite tool is a garden fork.
Yes.
Yes, digging a hole putting the food scraps from my kitchen into it. And then stirring it up also is really important, so you don't have clumps of the food, but you kind of coat all your new food with the active compost and the worms and the other insects and bugs that are in there.
Right.
So that, you know, that's a really important thing also. I was speaking to a friend of mine this weekend about this podcast, and she said, I don't understand this thing about turning. So how am I supposed to turn my pile? And she's right. You read these instructions from Cooperative Extension or whatever, and they say, you know, turning your pile can be very beneficial. It's also a ton of work. I think the operative term here is mixing more than turning. So you're not turning the whole pile, but you're mixing in these fresh ingredients into the active compost. And then, yes, topping it with some leaves or some straw or just some other of that browns that we always talk about, putting that on top to capture any odors that might be coming off of it.
Right.
That's much simpler than actually just turning your whole pile.
Right. And you spoke a minute ago about, you know, too much, you know, not putting too much of something in one place, like the food scraps and so forth. And I think that's really true with any ingredient. Like, you don't want to put all, you know, you just said brown, the things that are carbon rich, I think, and then versus green, the things that are nitrogen rich, I guess. And you don't want to, in any case, you don't want to put, you know, 10 feet of thick of something, of one thing, because it's not going to make a good
right.
chemistry, right?
Right. Although the other challenge she mentioned was this idea of 3-to-1 ratio, and, you know, 3 parts browns or high carbon materials to 1 part green or high nitrogen. And those ratios are true when you're starting a pile, if you're building a batch. But most of us don't build batches of compost. Most of us are kind of this process of always adding a little bit of one, adding some more of something else. And so those ratios are hard to make sense of. And I said, don't worry about it. It's as long as you have more of the bulky material to the food, and as long as you're mixing it in, that's really what's important. And don't worry about so much about the ratios, unless you're doing, if you want to have a hot compost and do a batch, yes, those ratios are important. But for the vast majority of us that are not doing that, that are just adding our kitchen scraps to our pile day to day or week to week, the ratio is less important than thinking about having not those big clumps.
Right.
That's a good way to put it.
Our kitchen scraps and, of course, our garden wastes, which are about to be prolific. In my case,
yes.
My pile is so big. It's like 40 feet long and 8 or 10 feet wide and high. It's this ridiculous thing. And I mean, I don't know where I would ever use all the finished compost I have over there, but whatever. Do you compost sort of hot? You just were speaking a little bit about hot. And what is hot? And what does that mean? And, you know, or is yours kind of a passive pile that takes its own good, you know, long, good time to get done?
Yes. Hot is important for the members of our organization that are making commercial compost and selling it to people, because the heat provides assurance that any pathogens were in there were killed, that weed seeds were killed, that things that could be toxic to plants are broken down. But at a slower, more passive pace, mine's not completely passive, but it's probably more passive than active. And so I get temperature rise. I have a thermometer because I'm in the business. So I can measure my compost temperatures. And I see that when I add a charge of food waste, the temperatures goes up, you know, maybe 15 or 20 degrees above ambient, but then it drops back down. It doesn't stay hot. And my pile certainly isn't reaching what you'll read about as thermophilic temperatures. My piles are not in the 120s or 130s or 40s or 50s or 60s the way commercial facilities are. But on the other hand, even last in the middle of winter, when it was well below freezing outside, this core of my pile was never froze. It stayed active enough over the winter to keep breaking down. And really, for me, the important thing is that I can keep adding the food scraps. So even after a year, more than a year of living in this house, I have not filled up my compost bin yet. In fact, it's only halfway full.
Oh.
Despite adding food every food scrap that I've made over the last year.
Well, I could bring you a few truckloads. I could bring you 70 or 80 truckloads.
Yeah, I take pails. I don't take trucks.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. I got to get my scale correct. Okay.
That's right.
So do you put in, you know, there's always these no-no lists, like no bones, no plants with diseases, no thing with seeds, weed seeds. What about you? Do you have rules about that?
My rule is don't worry about it. Because I'm not putting in, like, I don't put in a whole chicken carcass, but right. I don't worry about a few chicken bones getting in. I certainly don't worry about proteins, like, you know, leftover people. Yeah, they talk about fats and greases. And again, I've got a pretty big pile, so it's 4 feet across. Right. It's a cone. So I can add those things and I bury them, and they're it's not rat proof, but it's pretty animal proof in terms of, like, raccoons couldn't get into it, or larger things can't get in there. So I am fairly liberal about that. I know some of my cooperative extension friends would not like to hear this, but and I also don't worry about plants with diseases. I figure those diseases, if the plants got a disease, they didn't get it from my compost pile, and those materials are going to be in my compost pile probably for a year before I get on to sifting it out and screening it out. So they're not going to survive that environment. Same thing with weeds. The weeds that are in the garden didn't come from my compost. They came from someplace else. And so I don't think I'm contributing to the spread of weeds through my pile.
Right. The only thing I notice is that because I pass compost sort of mostly passively or around the same temperatures probably as yours, and not with a lot of turning and so forth. And it takes a year or whatever for the stuff to finish. And what I find is that certain really tenacious weeds that I have in the garden, you know, that sow a lot, you know, of seeds around, that if I take that compost and put it in a vegetable bed or put it top dress it somewhere else in the garden, those weed seeds will come up, and I have to be aware of that. And I have to either, before I use that compost, I could put like an old, I have a plastic shower curtain and I put that over there and I kind of solarize the, do you know what I mean? I kind of cook the weed seeds off on the part I'm going to use, or I just have to be aware and say to myself, hey, you know, there's going to be some weed seeds in here, Margaret. So when you put that on that bed, put a couple inches of good mulch on top of it too, so that you're not really encouraging everything to sprout at the same time. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I just have to be aware.
And also, by adding the compost, it's much easier to weed. So yeah, you do see sprouts come out, but they're easy to pull out as well.
And
try not to let them go to seed. That's the big thing.
Well, exactly. It would have been better to nip the bud off, literally the weeds wanting to set seed. And I'm just saying, sometimes they get ahead of me. Certain things get ahead of me. And, you know, whatever.
So yeah, I mean, we do have municipal composting, or at least township does collect compost. So I have some things that are really bad, I may send to them because I know their piles are going to get much hotter than mine. And
good point.
Not, you know, and so I, some things I might send that way, but not too much anymore.
Yeah. So speaking of sort of how long it takes, how hot it is, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I keep seeing on social media, you know, the first time you put a word in social media, if you talk to anyone about compost, then you start getting these ads for things related to compost, of course. And I keep seeing these ads for like instant compost maker machines to have inside my house. And it's like, what? What gives? Is there any such thing as instant compost? And what?
No.
Okay, good. We finished that topic.
you know, I of course get these also. And in fact, the claims are somewhat unbelievable, and while I would not want to use too strong language, but they do drive us crazy, because you can't make compost in 24 hours, not compost the way we think of as gardeners. And part of the problem is our language is a little insufficient to know what do we call this stuff that's been dried and ground and would add organic matter to your soil if you use it, but we don't really want to call it compost. It's not mature. It wouldn't pass any of the tests that we use to my members use to validate that our compost is mature and stable and doesn't have any bad aspects to it unlikely to anyways. You know, those machines wouldn't be able to produce the, meet those tests. On the other hand, they are, if you're using them and if money is no object, because the other thing is they're super expensive.
Right.
You know, they do, if as long as you're taking the product of that material and putting it into a garden, maybe you want to bury it because it's it could cause some problems in your soil. But so I'm a little worried about how those people get, how that material gets used. It is keeping material out of landfills, and land food in landfills does contribute to global warming. And we a lot of the movement, a lot of the pro-compost movement we've seen over the last decade really comes from the recognition of that food waste in landfills causes methane, a major contributor to greenhouse gases. So keeping that stuff out of landfills is really important. I think that you could probably do it cheaper and easier than these machines, but if that was, is that what floats your boat and you want to be one of the first people in your city to have one of these, I'm not going to say don't do it.
Right, but it's not humus.
It's not compost.
It's not humus.
It's not humus.
Right. It's not humus, and it's shredded, shredded, dehydrated
organic matter.
Last night's dinner.
Right.
Right. That's right. What it is.
It is. That's exactly. Yeah. The 24 hours, and you know, and you're using energy. You're taking a process. One of the things we love about composting is that it's self-heating. That you pile this stuff up and it gets heat by itself. You don't have to add energy to it. Whereas these machines take electricity. And they, you know, you're using power to do something that nature would do for you. It would take longer to do it, but what's your hurry?
Right.
I think, you know, yeah.
I say dig a hole outside if you don't want to have an above ground big pile and you only have the food. You know, dig a hole outside and do a little mini pit composter, or find a place for a bin or a tumbler outside and go for it. You know, I mean. I think
these are being marketed to, you know, people in high rises and condos. I don't know who's being marketed. I don't know who's buying them, actually.
Yeah.
I did see one that I thought was interesting because it was basically in place of your garbage disposal. So it would be put into under your sink, and instead of a garbage disposal just grinding everything up and sending it to your sewage plant, it grinds it but then separates it and into a dry material, or not a material that you then take it out, and would be perfect to then, if you're going to feed it to worms or you're going to put it in your compost, but it's already ground up, so it's small particle size. It actually would be, I mean, again, it's a, if there's a cost involved and there's, now you have the plumber and everything else, but I thought that was kind of a cool way to, especially like I said, especially if you had worms, because worms would eat this stuff up, you know, really quickly.
Right. So, there's this other thing that I also see a lot, which is the claims on, quote, plastic bags, you know, like garbage bags and grocery bags and bags, especially plastic, and some kinds of food containers too, that say it's compostable. What about that? Is that true? Is that what do you know about that?
Yes,
I know. What does the council think about that? You know?
I know too much about that. That's really that area of compostable products has really occupied a lot of my work life for the last several years.
And
in fact, we just did a whole conference on it this summer, because a lot of the information that you get on this comes from the manufacturers of the materials, not from composters. So there's a couple of different things here that I'd like to mention. One is that some of them are really compostable. And if you know that because they're certified, they'll carry a seal. In this country, that seal would be produced by the Biodegradable Products Institute, BPI. There are other organizations in other countries that put this material through. There are standards that says they have to disintegrate within 3 months and then fully decompose, that is, the microbes can use them as food within 6 months.
Oh.
But those are only certified for industrial scale composting. None of them are certified for home composting in this country. There are some of these organizations that will certify home compostable in Europe or in Australia, but not in this country. And that's because in this country, there's a little, they're taking a more cautious approach and saying it's not just more time. It actually has to decompose in your pile. And the problem is, what is a home composting pile? You know, we have home composters from Arizona that are always maybe it's too dry and it never gets hot because of that, versus composters in Maine where it's too cold and too wet. And so how do you make a material that you can certify as being able to break down in this wide variety of at least at a commercial scale? We know it's going to be 140 or 150. It's going to get turned. It's going to get managed to some extent. Whereas at a home level, we don't have any of those assurances. So I think we're being appropriately cautious in terms of certifying something for home composting. Now, those are things that are certified as compostable. And they should say, certified to compostable at a commercial facility. You may or may not have commercial facilities near you, but that's what it takes. If you see something that simply says biodegradable or compostable without any of these, without insignia, though, that's greenwashing. That's just what that is. And that is, I would not trust that. It's probably not true. And certainly isn't certified as true. And so that's the USDA, the U.S. Economic Service that produces the Federal Trade Commission has a series of what they call the green guides that says what kind of environmental claims can someone put on a packaging and what can't they? And they're about to revisit and renew the green guide. So we're looking forward to seeing what they can do. Right. The problem then becomes enforcement. Who's going to enforce?
Yes.
If one of your listeners sees something and says, in fact, I just got an email from a friend says, I got this container that says compostable in commercial facilities. What would happen if I
cut
up into chopped little pieces and put it in my home compost pile? And
yeah, I said, I think no. I think no. Let's not do it. I mean, yes, we could test it, but I don't want to run out of time for one really important question that I need to still ask you about. If I'm a person who needs more compost than I can make, which a lot of home gardeners are, what should I, so in the last 3 minutes or so, what should I be asking if I'm needing to buy compost? Like I prefer to buy bulk and skip all the plastic bags, speaking of plastic bags. Sure. And I love a composted stable bedding, which is kind of has animal waste.
Manure.
Yeah. And a lot of good nurseries, garden centers can tell you, not necessarily the big box stores, but private garden centers can tell you where there's a local supplier or whatever. But but let's say we can't do that or we only need a few bags. What do you say as an expert and someone representing the industry? Like, how the heck do I tell what to buy?
There are a couple of ways to do it. First thing would be, we do have in our industry a seal of testing assurance.
Oh.
And what that means is that the compost has been tested, has to meet some basic minimum standards in terms of has to produce at a facility that meets the environmental standards, it's permitted. It has to be tested. It has to pass pathogen tests, that is, it can't have pathogens in it, and has to... And include instructions for use. So what is this compost good for? Because compost that is good for, say, trees may not be the same compost that you want in your flower pots. And so we actually designate compost as good for certain uses. That program is starting to take off. You might find that seal of testing assurance or that they'll call the C cup, the consumer compost use program. If you don't see that, one thing that you can do is ask whoever you're getting it, and I agree with you, first of all, buying it from a local garden center who's probably carrying it bulk from a local producer, that's my first choice.
Yeah, good.
Because you can see it. But if you can't do that and you're looking at bags, you can ask them to open a bag up. Does it look like something you'd want to add to your compost? And so often it's hard to buy something blind. And so they should be able to allow you have a bag that's already torn that you can look. Does it feel moist or is it dry? Is it all twiggy or is it has some fine texture to it? Does it smell good? Does it smell like something you'd want to add, or has it gone sour in the bag? Because that's a sign that it was maybe too wet or was bagged too early. Mm. So those are some things that if you have any experience with compost, you can use that to judge, make some basic judgments on a material.
Well, Carrie Oceans from the U.S. Composting Council and Backyard Composter, I understand you just put up a brand new garden gate, except it's not a gate to the garden, it's a gate to the compost area of your garden. A fancy gate, huh?
Yes, we built a new deer fence for our new garden, which is a no-dig garden. I'm sure you do lots of information about that. But we didn't have a way to get from the back of the garden out to the compost area, so we built a beautiful new gate that goes out of the garden into my composting area.
Perfect.
We're happy to share that with you.
Well, I'm going to get some pictures from you to accompany this podcast transcript on awaytogarden.com. And thank you for making the time today. I hope we'll talk again soon.
I can't believe how fast the time flew.
Indeed, it does. It's a pleasure for me too. Thanks, Carrie.
You're welcome. Bye bye now.
Underwriting support by Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs, supplying landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners with new ideas and high-quality flower bulbs for fall planting. Plant tulips, plant daffodils, plant Color Blends this fall. Available at colorblends.com.
And thanks to all of you for listening. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify, and you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy composting and gardening meantime.
Away to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.